Welcome to the USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast. USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast is the original podcast covering USC Trojans men's college basketball team and is available on such platforms as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and TuneIn, as well as at the USCHoops.com website. If you haven't done so already, we'd really appreciate it if you gave us a five-star rating and left a review on the platform of your choice. And a very happy Wednesday, April 8th, 2026 to everybody. Happy April. We're done with March. You're sadly done with college basketball this season, although for a USC basketball fan, this might be some good news. And there's going to be some more good news we're going to talk about here shortly. But we got the original team back with us. So Nick is here and Jason is back. So Nick, Jason, how are you guys holding up?
Doing well, Chase. Yeah, best month of the year is over, but congrats to the Michigan Wolverines, and yeah, plenty of news to talk about.
All good, Chase.
Yeah, so Jason, what did you think of the what was your impression of the tournament? What did you think I mean, we didn't have a chance to talk to you about this beforehand. What did you think was going to happen going in, and you know, what did you think when it actually happened?
Well, you teed me up beautifully, because I did win one of my pools. I did have Michigan winning. Was a little concerned with the injury situation that they had going into the tournament, but I just couldn't get out of my head how dominant they were, especially kind of toward the middle part of that season. And we saw that firsthand, obviously, with USC, but that stretch where they were just beating every good team by 30, 40 points was what was lingering in my head when I filled out my bracket. And that pretty much came to pass through the tournament, except for that last game where UConn gave them all they could handle. And what a run for Dan Hurley and his team to make it to the third championship game in 4 years. I mean, you can't say enough about that program. So very, very impressive on both of those fronts. And another fun tournament. This was a good season of college basketball. Kind of looking back, it was, you know, lots of interesting twists and turns, lots of good teams. You know, I think a lot of people have said, you know, is a transfer portal kind of killing the game? And certainly some USC fans will say, you know, it's hard to get used to new rosters every year. But ultimately, like, the quality of play is better than it's been. I think NIL keeping a lot of these guys in school, you know, when you turn on your TV, it looks the right way, and it's pretty great. And now we're getting into the season where USC gets to build a new roster and start all over again.
So Nick, when I was younger, in my younger days, I was in high school, I think, when Kevin Garnett announced it was him, and I can't remember who the other guy was with him, but they announced that they were not going to even go to college. They were going to go straight to the NBA. And it was kind of a shock. It sent a shock through the system. And there's already a trend toward guys leaving after maybe 1 year. I think Stephon Marbury left after a year. And guys only staying 2 years, like Chris Webber only stayed 2 years. But that really signaled kind of a slow, I don't want to say like deterioration of, but like from the, There was a couple exceptions, like some Duke teams and the, you know, the Duke Arizona final in like 2001. But there was kind of like a slow drip, drip, drip of games getting weaker. Then we had the one and done rule. It kind of propped up the sport a little bit. But then you still had, it was kind of like an iffy period. These last couple of years, I think, have been the strongest in like 3 decades for college. But this is quality of play. This year was insane because of like, all the European players coming over and how good this freshman class was, historically good. And the tournament was great up until we got into these, like, with the crazy shooting situation you get to in the Final Four with, I don't know, it's the Rim or the big stadium that they're playing in. And, you know, the shooting percentages were really low, but it was an amazing season of college basketball. And I do think this Michigan team was kind of a special team historically. I'm not going to say, oh, this is the greatest team ever. But like, they were very dominant. And they were dominant in certain times that were like noticeable, like, you know, like UNLV type domination. Not in the finals, but where you're just blowing the doors off teams. So what do you think? You're a little bit younger than me. What are your impressions of this season compared to your experience with college basketball leading up to now?
Well, Chase, I guess in my younger days, there was a thing called the G League Ignite where guys would go and play for a year in front of no fans and then go to the NBA. No, I think, Jason touched on it a little bit, but you have the historically good freshman class. And then, Chase, you hit on it too with the Europeans. So I think you have several forces like the great freshman class, the Europeanization of college basketball with the more professional model. And then you still have kind of the stragglers from the COVID year, like Chad Baker-Mazzara being 26 and in college. So you combine all these factors and you get, a really high level product. And with respect to the finals specifically, I saw a lot of people say like if UConn, had a normal shooting game, then they would have beat Michigan and yada yada yada. But you watch that game and Michigan had a poor shooting game and Yaxa Lundenborg wasn't even close to 100%. So I think you just really have to hand it to Michigan. They defended all game. It was a beautifully constructed roster. And the other argument I've seen is it was all about NIL and Dusty just brought in just an insane, unbelievable amount of talent. And it was a very talented team, don't get me wrong, but Ade Mara played 13 minutes a game at UCLA. It wasn't like he was some superstar, even though Mick didn't. I don't think he used him right. Yaxel was obviously their big ticket guy, but Roddy Gale was kind of mediocre at Ohio State, and he was a returner for them. And Elliot Cadeau was run out of Chapel Hill. Hubert Davis would cuss him out for shooting threes in practice, and he wasn't a great passer, but there were a lot of questions there on his ceiling, and Dusty brought them all together, and he struck gold, right? So you got a hand to Michigan. Beyond that, I think when you look at Illinois in the Final Four, Michigan in the final, like Ade Mara playing the way he did and defending the rim in that final, Illinois just with all of their Euros and their bigs. Tommy Lloyd at Arizona, who was our pick to win the final, having a lot of great Europeans on that team. And, I think you have to look at this year, study those rosters, because roster construction is more important now than ever, just with the European angle, the portal, high school evaluations. There are multiple ways to skin a cat, but, it's very different than I think any other era of college basketball.
Yeah, and you anticipated kind of where I was going to go with this. One thing I have to say, what Dusty did is he may not have, he's got Yaxel, which is like the number one, transfer player
Right.
for quite a while. But what he really did was corner the market on really elite guys around the rim. Getting Morez and Adai Mora. And now Morez was an interesting situation because he had a really nice freshman year for Illinois, but no one, wasn't clear exactly where he was, how well or how strong he was going to be until you got the U19 Team USA over the summer, last summer, when he was actually, I think he and maybe one other guy were young enough. They'd actually played college basketball and they're young enough to actually participate on that team, which was mainly high school players. And he just looked phenomenal in that. And you could kind of say, oh my goodness, if Mara can kind of show up somehow when some of the games you've seen with UCLA and what they've done, this Michigan team is just going to be brutal in that front court. And that's what you ended up seeing. I mean, all the pieces kind of came together with that front court. And I think now even though UConn does not have the kind of the front court size that Illinois and Arizona have, they did have Terrace Reed as a kind of elder of basketball and had really come along and he's a big, strong guy. I think the model you're going to see going forward, and this is maybe Jason I want to talk to you about, is I think the model is going to be more like a little bit of a throwback, big bigs and around the rim and guys who can shoot it. So the must model of positionless basketball. I'm not even sure Muss is going to go forward with that, or if he does go forward with that, he's going to go forward with it with much taller players, and maybe that's what he envisions for a guy like Adonis Ratliff, maybe for Jacob Kofi if he resigns. But some of the names you're seeing USC associated with the portal so far are like more traditional guards, and then some real bigs like the Seton Hall freshman Najai Hines. So what do you think about that, Jason?
So I think I saw some commentary about Dusty May being interviewed about this, and basically he said, I was just kind of following basketball, and like who's kind of the flagship of basketball right now is Oklahoma City, and it's like when everybody else was sizing down in the NBA, like OKC sized up, and so I said, like, if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for us, basically, and that was kind of the impetus for going out there and getting a bunch of bigs. And it makes sense in that, and Todd Golden's also talked about this recently. When Golden was at San Francisco, they let the threes fly, but since he's been at Florida, they've also gone rather big. And I think it's kind of a difference between the way you have to win at the mid-major level, maybe with a little bit more, money ball analytics, 3-point shooting, right? But like at the top echelon of the sport, if you have the money, you have the budget, that you can create such a physical mismatch that it almost makes it impossible for you to be upset, in earlier rounds of the tournament. In other words, there's a certain level of consistency and kind of baseline size mismatch that just makes it very difficult for a smaller school to compete with you. Now, does that win deeper on into the tournament? Like this year, obviously it did. I'm not positive about that, but I will say in like some of the analysis I've done of just coaching careers and kind of like what I would call like tourney DNA, right? It is definitely a more physical game in the tournament. It's more ISO heavy, less ball movement, more kind of straight line driving, less emphasis on 3-point shooting. So, not surprising that it's moved in this direction, but it is, it's for the schools that have the budget to get the bigs that can make it work, right? Like you can't just throw any 3 7-footers on the court at the same time and expect it to go well. So this is a place where like if you have the resources, you can really make it work.
Yeah, and that's and the and you have a guy like Jaxel Lundenberg. He's a unicorn a little bit, right? And because you can find guys that play the three spot that are whatever 6'8", 6'9", how he is. You don't normally find them that are true power players. Like he's a true power player, and he's able to play the three. His 3-point shooting was not great all season. He kind of came on at the end, but his ball handling, his basketball awareness, his side to side lateral movement, he can guard the three very easily. He can guard guards, so he could get that done at that spot. So you can go ultra big. Match up. Have two non outside shooting bigs in Morez Johnson and Adaimara that can just dominate the rim, but really aren't much of a factor facing up from, let's say, mid-range out. And you can do that as long as you are using those players correctly. You are getting the ball to them. You're not wasting them on the court. And that's kind of what we saw from Michigan. Illinois did it a little bit differently because all of their big guys were, while they could also score around the rim, they weren't quite the power players that Michigan had, but they were shooters. So you can get further out. Arizona is more of in the kind of the vein of Michigan. They just didn't have quite, I think, the talent that Michigan had, but they had a similar situation where they had these power players around the rim, Mo Crivas, Toby Awaka, and Koa Peet. When they the teams finally went head to head, Michigan was just a little bit too much for them, I think. They're just the better, bigger guys around the rim. I'm curious to see what direction Muss affirmatively moves in now. I will say, maybe we should just discuss for a second what we're seeing with these trends in the transfer portal, because I had convinced myself that with the rev share money coming in, and the teams kind of stocking up on NIL, and also kind of then whatever the clearinghouse rules, the teams were going to try to spend a lot more to retain players. And that could be true in some instance, but we're starting to get to the point now. The portal has now only been officially open for about 24 hours or 48 hours, whatever it is. And we're almost to the point where we have just as many kind of upper tier players in the portal as we had all of last portal season. I would measure that going by Evan Miakawa's rating system that he had. He has, I don't use the fan site rating systems. I think Jason and I both prefer Evan. And Evan had in last year, he in his rating system, which is a 5-star max scale, he had, I think, what was it? Was it 61 five stars? I can't remember the exact number that we went over. Let's see. He had, well, maybe he only had 49 last year, and he's already, I think we're already at the point where we're up to 44 this year. I think, the way the trends have gone, we're going to see more guys jump in. So this portal is going to be just as talented as last year. I'm surprised that's happening. Nick predicted it's going to happen. So Nick, credit to you. I was wrong. What are your Nick? What are you seeing when you look at the portal at this point in time? What are you seeing in there, and what trends are you noticing?
Yeah, Chase. I mean, we've talked about this a bit offline, but I just see it as a pure supply demand, function, right? Like if the demand is there for top transfers, and clearly there is, right? And especially when you consider that the high school class isn't quite as strong this year, you're going to have these blue bloods like Duke and Kentucky not having a single high school commit. They're going to have a lot of cash and bags to drop on these guys. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of quality guards like John Blackwell entered, which was pretty interesting. You have a Caden Loudis at Villanova who turned down $3 million from Villanova, which kind of feels the same, but maybe there's a payday out there from a Miami or a Texas out there for him. The bigs seem to be commanding the top dollar. Flory Badunga, I think, is the biggest name. I'm sure he's going to get 5, 6 million from somebody, or at least ask for it. I don't know what else I can add at that point, but retention seems like a big priority, and some schools have done it, I think, successfully, and some haven't. I read that a lot of Duke's guys they thought were going to retain, asked for 2 to 3 times the amount of NIL that Duke was willing to pay them. So it's going to be really hard for these traditional powers to stack rosters and build just elite 1 through 9 rotations. And in a way, it reminds me of like the Alabamas of the world in football, who used to stack 5 stars on their second and third teams, just not being able to do it anymore. So I know you've had the elite top teams, but I do think there is going to be a little bit more parity in the sport moving forward, where maybe the separation is there between high major teams and mid-major teams. But I would be surprised if you continue to have like a conglomerate of 4 or 5 elite teams that are clearly better than the rest of the field.
Jason, do you think, well, first off, does it surprise you that we seem to be trending in the same direction as last year, even though teams, could you would have think would have signed players to multi-year deals or prepared for this a little better for retention? You hear the story about a Caden Lewis and Villanova, and it's hard to believe that, a guard would demand this much money. I guess they offered him $3 million. This is according to Troy Donovan. So, I mean, it's possible he got wrong, bad information from an agent, but the school offered him $3 million. He's like, no, that's not enough. I mean, if you look at the portal itself, there's a lot of substitute guys for for a guy like Lewis, maybe he's right to demand more than $3 million, but you would think it'd be close enough that he could settle on 3.1 or something like that. Do you think that, are you surprised by what we're seeing, or do you think that this is, were you expecting this?
It is a little bit of both. I mean, it is like just the sheer numbers of it is pretty overwhelming. I was just doing an exercise the other day where I was like kind of looking at the top. I took like the top 2,500 players by Bart Torvik's Porpagatu stat. It's like points, rebounds per game, etc. And so I just pulled like what I thought was a pretty wide swath of everybody that played meaningful minutes. I think I set it at like 30. You've played 30% of your team's minutes, and it was just sorted by that stat. And I pulled 2,500 players, and I started cross-referencing it against Evan Mia's transfer list, thinking like, oh, like, most of these transfers are going to be on the list. And probably about half of the transfer portal guys like didn't even register on the top 2,500 players. Like it's like there's this whole underbelly, if you will, of guys that aren't seeing meaningful minutes that are hopping the portal looking for the next opportunity. And so there's a lot of quantity and there's less quality, but there's still enough quality if you are shopping in the right places. But yeah, it seems like every year, and it's like a lot of these kids, right? They're not going to play in the NBA, so they've just decided this is like I'm going to make myself a free agent every year and see what I can do. But I do think, right, it's like, when the I don't know what analogy I'm looking for, but the musical chair, the music stops, like some of these guys may not find a better home once these rosters start filling up. So that's what gives me pause about so many guys going in is like, if you had a spot and you were comfortable somewhere, like don't just hop in the portal thinking it's going to be better because yeah, there's a lot of you have a lot of company in the portal.
Yeah, and unfortunately for a lot of these guys, they're every incentive they're going to hear is going to be to jump in the portal, right? Because they all want to have agents, so they all have agents now. Well, if a team is offering $200,000, the commission on that for an agent is kind of like you can round that down to zero effectively. It's non-meaningful dollars, so they're going to push them. Hey, get in the portal, get in the portal. And see if you can make a little money this time around. Even if even for them, the risk is much greater for the athlete than it is for the agent, right? Because whatever cut the agent's taking of a lower tier player, they're just trying to swing for a home run and maybe some surprising large offer come out of nowhere. Nick, so I had told you, and it's on the Discord, and for those of you who don't know, join us in the Discord. Great conversations. But I had advocated for a certain kind of strategy for approaching the portal, which was make your hero offers very, very early, with big amounts, pay over market, lock down your guys, then wait. So I don't think
The
that's what,
Donovan Dent, right? That's
right, that
last year.
exactly. Donovan Dent. I don't think that was a possibility this year just because of the 2 week gap between when the season was effectively ending for teams and when the portal actually opened. For some teams it was 3 weeks. And in that amount of time, guys are like jumping into the portal, but they're not actually really in the portal. Teams can talk to their agents, but it was very hard to get a sense of what the market is because it was just this kind of drip, 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 drip. I'm going to spoil alert for everybody. We cannot verify this. We have no verification, but on the burner site, it has been reported by Troy Donovan that Rodney Rice has re-signed with USC to come back. I bring that up because I think that's kind of the hero offer USC probably ends up making for both he and for Jacob Kofi. We'll see what the news is with Jacob Kofi. The two of them would kind of be the pillars of the team coming back with the freshmen. If Kofi does re-sign with the team, you do have these kind of like two kind of foundational pieces. You've got these interesting freshmen. And then I think my personal belief here, Nick, just on the direction that some of this is going and the fact that some teams are already talking about that they don't have the money that they had last year. I think we're going to hit a point in the portal where maybe by the time we're a week after it closes for new entrants, that there is going to be some really, some bargain pricing for certainly for guards. I'm not sure for bigs. Bigs might be all swooped up, but I think for guards and wings, you might be able to get some really interesting pricing on that. We have not seen it. I don't think we've seen any commitments yet. We've seen some picks from the fan sites that they think these guys are going to sign at a couple places, but I don't think anything is beneficial yet. And what's your thought? I'm kind of rambling at this point, Nick, but what's your thought about, trying to get these foundational pieces locked in? And then once you have that, maybe at that point you're like, okay, maybe get one big more big man, and then we can get guards down the road. We don't have to spend a lot of money on that.
Yeah, I think that's right, Chase. And I kind of like the, Rodney Rice to, I guess, Donovan Dent comparison in a sense, right? Like you have a marquee guard that you're locking in early. And it's kind of weird to think about it this way, but the first players that were locked in were the McDonald's All-Americans, right? Even though they're not on campus. So, you kind of have those pieces, and then you add Rodney Rice, and then hopefully you add Kofi, and that's a huge chunk of your rotation right there. And then you can be a little bit pickier. You can, save whatever NIL funds you have left and see if prices drop for, maybe some of the higher tier portal guys that haven't found a home. Because I think if you're talking about paying a Caden Lewis level player $3.5 or $4 million, I think that's just nuts. And you kind of touched on it too. These agents are throwing around these huge numbers, and I would do the same if I were an agent too, right? Like it's a negotiation. But I think the only guy committed is Michael Nwoko, who went to Xavier. Maybe there have been a few others, but it definitely seems to be a lot slower. Typically, there's not like a oftentimes by this point in the portal, you know what school a kid is going to. And now it seems more like there's a list of schools or a group of like two to three. Like you hear Texas and Miami with the Caden Lewis. You hear Illinois, Duke, and Michigan with John Blackwell. But agents seem to be pinning a small group of schools against one another to try to maximize the amount their client gets. So it's really interesting, and I think the elite guys are probably going to go off the board first, because I think schools are allocating more dollars towards the top players this year, and fewer towards the maybe mid-tier players. But I think we'll probably get some action on these top guys soon, and maybe in a couple of weeks you just have all of these like solid rotation players, and fewer dollars chasing those amongst the schools.
Yeah, so Jason, it's a really strange kind of portal calendar they've created this year. I think they did this on purpose. They did not. They were trying to limit the amount of transfers. I don't think they were able to successfully do that. The window the portal's open. Now, remember, that doesn't mean you can't sign after the portal closes. You just can't jump into the portal after it closes. It closes on the 21st, so it's only been open now, since Tuesday. The day after the national championship game, which I guess is yesterday now, we're in a quiet period, meaning that while these players can communicate with the staffs, they can't visit campuses officially right now. So, you start this portal, a very relatively short portal window of 2 weeks, and you're in a quiet period, so you can't take the visits really until the weekends come around. I mean, this weekend I'm assuming is just going to be a huge, huge weekend for vi visitors, but we're going to know, I have a feeling, by Monday, if this thing is going to kind of, if the prices are going to kind of start crashing down, if these large amounts are going to get paid. I mean, I'm assuming, this weekend's going to tell us a lot about the nature of how the portal is going to look, because there's only 2 weekends to this portal being open, and the first one is this weekend.
Yeah, Chase, and from what I heard, Asking prices were, well, taking a step back, I think we had heard, hey, last year was kind of still Wild West. The rev share wasn't fully in place with teeth, and we thought, oh, the clearinghouse is really gonna be, cracking down on illegitimate deals, and this may be the last year that players are really gonna be able to cash in, and subsequent portal cycles, the market is gonna correct itself. But I don't think that enforcement situation has changed meaningfully at all. You add the rev share in, you just add the, people know what the market was last year, and it sounds like prices are not dropping, but just continuing to increase. And I think I heard one person say that they thought it was like a 20 to 30% increase was like kind of across the board what they were seeing. So I don't necessarily think this is like sustainable for the financial health of these programs, or that boosters are going to be happy about continuing to write these checks into the long term. But I think for this season, it seems like prices are still high and climbing.
Yeah, I went ahead and splurged for the Evan Miyakawa front office suite package, which is not cheap, but it does give you information about NIL, and it comes basically loaded with last year's pricing, and then you can kind of try to update it to this year's pricing using a sample of NIL numbers. You have to do five at minimum that you've heard. Now, this I can only report from the reliable sources I've heard from. That includes like what's on the burner with Trilli Donovan, some other sources as well. But yeah, the prices jumped quite a bit once I inputted this year's rumored prices that I'm seeing. The last year's prices were actually, and this is based upon real data from schools and agents, last year's prices were actually much lower than I would have anticipated. As it turns out, at least on their site, and I think Evan does a really strives to have accurate information. So it surprised me to see, but this year they're not. And what you're seeing is the price for guards, generally speaking, is anywhere from 1.5 to 2.5 is like what they think the value is. With the exception of top guys who go 3 million and above. Of course, to lock them down, you're going to need to overpay those prices because nobody is going, unless they're really worried about their status and not finding a contract, you're going to try to shoot for a price above that as long as you possibly can. And we're still early enough in the process that people are going to be shooting for higher prices. Now, it's a little different with the big men. There's not as many of them available this year. And I know they're going to be, because of what we saw in the Final Four and with Michigan, the big men are going to be at a prime for sure. But right now, there aren't that many like really notable guys that are officially in the portal. However, there are some guys that are kind of just getting in now. So you're finally seeing Thiem from Cincinnati and Jopp from ASU get in. So I'm not entirely clear on what the prices are going to look like for those guys. I think they'll be very high. I think every team is going to want to have at least, all the top teams are going to want to have at least one of those kind of like, quality big men to be a foundation of their team. I know USC has made inquiries about the Seton Hall player, freshman Hines. So we'll see how the numbers end up working out, but I do think what's going to end up happening here is my guess is, and I don't know if you think this will happen, Nick, I have a feeling the top guards are going to get taken. And then the ones that are left, I think teams are not necessarily going to want to pay extra for a guard unless he's like a really elite scorer, really elite 3-point shooter, guys who just are kind of like pretty good scorers, but potentially replaceable with other players. I think you're going to see the NI their prices drop quite a bit toward the end of this process. That's just my guess, Nick.
I think that's right, and I think that just the size element is going to come into play too. Like if you're an undersized, combo guard, maybe you score 15 to 20 at the mid-major level. I don't think those guys are going to be able to get a ton, and One example, this isn't a mid-major player, but I thought it was interesting that it was reported that USC is going to have a Zoom with Bryce Lindsey from Villanova. And my guess what happened there is he probably heard what they offered to Caden Lewis and then asked for a similar amount of money. And Villanova told him to pound sand, and now they're both in the portal. So, but I think that's kind of the archetype, right? That might not get as much, just not elite player, not a big, and I good shooter, didn't have like an elite shooting year, but I think that's kind of the profile you're mentioning here. But I think that just, makes it all the more important that USC locked in Rodney Rice, because if you do have inflation at the high end of the guard market as opposed to the kind of mid-tier guards, you already locked up that player, and maybe you can save and get another rotation guard for a reasonable price and allocate your remaining money towards one of those bigs, whether it be a Jopp or a Hines or someone of that stature.
Jason, you have done some work for us already on kind of scouting the potential players in the portal that kind of match the must system and then at match also some efficiency metrics that you're interested in. Can you just like give us tell us about what you've done, and all this is available in the Discord if people want to take a look at it, but it's really great stuff as usual.
Yeah, so I tried doing this last year, and I've adapted it a little bit. I tried to be a little bit more statistically rigorous about my process here. But basically, what I've tried to do, and I alluded to this earlier, this is what I was pulling the list of 2,500 players for, was to, I think Evan does a great job with rating the actual players. So if you're just trying to say, is player A better, player B better, like he's got the numbers with his, BPR stats on offense and defense to say like this player is better than that player. But what I like to do is put, another lens on it of, okay, but if the players were equally good, like which one would be a better fit for Mus's style, which is very distinct, right? It's, physicality, rim pressure, try to get to the line on offense, and not everybody fits that archetype. Obviously, a smaller guy that stands in the corner and shoots threes would be kind of like the opposite of, the physicality that Mus would want, the athleticism certainly that Mus's teams historically have played with. So I scored all the players from last season, against kind of like what the prototypical Musselman player would look like. And then I just started trying to look at like, okay, who would kind of fit that archetype versus who is actually in the portal. And it's not a huge cross section of guys that are actually in right now that check the boxes on all of those metrics. But there are a couple. And I'll pull it here in a second, Chase. Just give me a moment to pull
Yeah,
it.
and while I'm doing that,
Right.
we can start with the questions because the first one's going to dive right into this, which was
Yep.
from Coop 7177. He asked, "What's our wish list from the portal?" And so, I mean, once you pull this up, it will be kind of very interesting to take a look at some of the guys that are available and some of the guys that might fit this. I will just say, for me, I would love to have a guard to pair with Rodney Rice that is a bit of a shooter. So that, the perfect example for me would be somebody like DGL, that's Draw Gibbs Lawhorn of UNLV. I think he'd be very interested, very interesting as being able to pair him with Rodney Rice. I don't know if that's a possibility. What we have seen though recently is Christian Hammond from Santa Clara becoming available, and he might be a guy that because we've showed some interest, and he might be an ideal pairing. A totally different type of pairing would be somebody that Coach Will Conroy recruited out of high school and actually got him to sign, well, with Washington, and that's Zoom Diallo, who is not as much of a shooter, although his shooting is starting to come on now, and he seems to be a player who's rising. his profile and potentially turning himself into an NBA player. Jason, are you ready with that?
I'm ready. So let me just give you a rundown. So this was as of yesterday, so it may already be outdated because I think from yesterday to today I refreshed my Evan Mia. I think that the count went from like 1690 to 1800. So we've got another 100 guys in there. So this was my list of players that are not necessarily in the portal, but these are my best players in college basketball that aren't projected to be first round picks. That are, you could be back channeling with them right now. And this would be like, these are the ideal people to both be good and fit into an Eric Musselman system. So I'll read it down. The guards, Nick's favorite, Tyler Tanner from Vanderbilt, Mason Falslev, Utah State, Okori from Stanford, Chance Westry from UAB, who I think
He
hopped
just
in today.
popped in today, yes.
Yeah, Christian Anderson.
Very top of Evan's list, by the way. He's the top
Yeah.
guard available, yeah.
So that would be like a home run kind of play. Christian Anderson, Texas Tech, DeShane Montgomery, Dayton, Silas Demery, obviously we know from Connecticut and his former commitment here. Joshua Dent, St. Mary's, Jake Hall, New Mexico, and Boogie Flynn from Florida. Those are my top guards. Top wings, Davis Fogel, Gonzaga, Jordan Burks, UCF. Jackson Holcomb from Utah Valley, Price Sanford, Nebraska, Jason Green, Creighton, Ian Scott, Indiana State, Miles Bird from San Diego State, Kellen Thames, St. Louis, Karchenko from Arizona, and Fulgaris from Iowa. And then my top bigs as Musk scheme fits, Mara from Michigan, Krivas, Arizona, Nolan Winter from Wisconsin, Vassar from UNC, Morez from Michigan, Chinyelu from Florida, Bidonga, who we know is in, Frew from Louisville, who is in, Drew Skarnowski from Belmont, who is also in, and Zvonimir Ivicic from Illinois. So of that list, Holcomb, the wing from Utah Valley, is in, Miles Bird from San Diego State is in, Bidonga, Frew, Skarnowski, and then we just mentioned Chance Westry. So those are some of my Venn diagram of best potential players for bus, and then the ones that are actually in the portal right now.
Nick, do you have some guys that you really like?
Yeah, I mean, great list from Jason there. I saw it posted in the Discord that, they're throwing their hat in the ring with Donnie Freeman, who I think is pretty interesting from Syracuse. He's a former McDonald's All-American who averaged, I want to say, 16 and maybe like 8 or so. But obviously, like, fits the Musk brand of like physicality, a lot of functional strength and production. So he's kind of interesting. I presume that's going to be a really, really expensive one. But no, I'm really fascinated by how they decide to allocate the remaining NIL. Like, I don't know, would you guys prefer like to get a Najee Hines and like a Bryce Lindsey to round out the roster? Or would you prefer to go bigger for like a Flory Badunga type or Isaiah Johnson type at guard, even if it means sacrificing an elite player at the other position, where you maybe stick with the Gabe Dines if you get an Isaiah Johnson type? Like, is there a preference that you guys have in terms of remaining roster construction?
My personal preference, just in this based upon the market as well, is I think you're much more likely to be able to get a replacement player for a guard once you have your like foundational guard, which we have now, hopefully. So I would go, if you get Batunga, I mean, I think that's a no, absolutely no brainer. You would take him over anybody. But you talked about Freeman. I mean, I would take the big man. You hopefully you can pair him with Kofi, and then you also have Adonis Ratliff, so potentially you have a nice rotation of bigs. You have a little depth there. You potentially do have Gabe Dines coming off the bench as well. I would personally take that. I don't know where you're at with that, Jason.
I could go either way. I mean, I do think that we really need, obviously you get shooting back with Rice, but even if Rice was there, I'm still not sure we had enough of it by the end of last season. And it also would depend like what happens with the rest of the retention. Like, is Kofi coming back in this situation? Like, if so, like you've covered another, front court rotation player, certainly. And you've got the Ratliffs, and if you have Dines, and you've got the length with Christian Collins, it feels to me like we're light on the backcourt. Now, as you said, Chase, that's money dependent as well, right? It's what is the budget, and who can you get, and perhaps the dollars go further at guard. But in terms of team need, I am trying to stack guards that can, distribute and shoot. If you can kind of go back and forth, if you want to keep Rice on the ball as he was last year, play him off the ball as he did at Maryland, but you need more ball handling. That's and obviously, $1 million question that it hasn't even come up on this conversation is what's going on with Elijah, right? That would be another key factor in terms of how you try to shape this roster.
Yes, 100%. I think the approach with Elijah is somewhat similar to what I suggested on the last podcast. I think when we discussed this, Nick, which was just build your team, assuming he won't be there. But if he is there at the end, then he's just there. Then you've got him as well, and you can figure that out, right? There'll be other, maybe other donors will step up to pay for a guy like Elijah, but build your core team, assuming he won't be around. That was my thinking. And just kind of going off what Jason was talking about there, I think one here's just a funny little if you go by the Evan Miakawa transfer portal rankings, the current rankings, just Nick, take a wild guess. Where do you think Christian Hammond is ranked in the in Evan Miakawa's ranking of the guys currently in the transfer portal?
Oh wow. 30, 20 to 30.
He's ranked 241st.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Wow.
So the projected NIL on Hammond that Evan has for him is basically $460,000. So that's why I say, look, maybe he's way undervalued here, but if you look at the guys right around him, somebody, and maybe he's much better than these guys, but at least for Evan, he does not value him as much. It's funny, actually values Liam Campbell from St. Mary's more. That's a hard pill to swallow.
Right,
And
right.
Jordan Marsh more, but there's still guys in this range around that $200 spot mark. And maybe they'll be wrong, but there are guys there that can give you some shooting. Maybe not the elite, super elite shooting that you want, but I do think you can find guys if you really scout hard enough. I think last year that was just never really a strong enough consideration, Jason, I think, because they got Brunell and they thought, okay, we basically we're gonna have Elijah, because remember, Elijah did not hurt when they were putting together the roster. We're gonna have Elijah, we're gonna have Rice, we're gonna have We have Chad Baker now, so we don't have to worry about finding someone to go with Desmond Claude that can actually shoot. And now we've added Brunell, and maybe we're going to add this Yakov guy from over in Europe to kind of round out the shooting on the team. I don't think they really anticipated, all the little things that would happen with the guys that could actually shoot. And they, so they didn't, they essentially took a whole bunch of guards that were non-shooters. I don't think they're going to do that again. I think you can actually find some shooters if you prioritize that, but I could be wrong about that. Okay, so let's go to the next question. Is USC looking at players for 1 year contracts or multiple year contracts? This is such a great question that I just don't know the answer to. I'm not sure if either of you guys know for sure. I'm assuming that there probably is a multi-year aspect to these contracts, but they can always be bought out, which is probably a factor. But I'm guessing, if Rice got done here, I'm guessing he was on a multi-year contract, but we had to sweeten it so that he didn't jump into the portal and basically look to have that contract bought out. I don't know if you have any information on that, Jason, or Nick, if you want to jump in on that.
No,
I'll
I'll just
just
make a quick
go ahead.
comment on the just on the multi-year contract angle, right? Like if there was a conversation about Rice entering the portal, then clearly the language either wasn't tight enough or the buyout wasn't large enough to the point where it was still a negotiation, right? So, you know, with a lot of these coaches, you talk about these coaches with $10 to $15 million buyouts, and it's a real factor, you know, with these schools when they're trying to hire a new coach. So, part of it might be, you know, schools don't want to play the bad cop and, you know, try to sue a player or whatnot. But, you know, it does seem like it's always going to be a year-to-year sort of deal with you know, with your players, unless something changes.
Jason, do you have any thoughts?
No, I would just say the proof's probably in the pudding in that, like, have you guys really heard of like any situation with a player either on the basketball or the football side where it was like, oh, he signed this really bad team-friendly deal and now he's stuck there? Like, I just haven't heard that come up really. Like, you would think if like they signed a real multi-year contract that has teeth and they don't really have a way out of it, that like you would know about it. But it seems that like anything with the right amount of money or the right amount of buyout, you know, is still up for negotiation these days.
Yeah, and one of the problems is if you breach a contract like that, the remedy is not really to restrain somebody from going in seeking money from another party. The remedy is damages. It's money. So, you know, that's kind of what we saw, I think, in the situation with the quarterback from Washington, where, you know, he had taken revenue share money from Washington, signed a deal, and then, you know, tries to put himself into the portal. And I think the reason his agent basically was threatening to quit on him was because it wasn't because there was going to be some court telling him he couldn't do it. It was that the financial consequences of breaching the contract were so high. So I do know, though, that, you know, Chad Baker Mazzara signed a deal or agreed to terms with Auburn when USC got him last year. We did have to pay Auburn to get him. So that was, you know, the remedy was not that Chad Baker could never play anywhere else. The remedy was that we had to buy him out of the contract or else he was in breach. So, you know, just something to keep an eye on. And courts generally, because we're kind of in the realm of non-competes. You know, you can't go to compete with, like, courts generally don't favor those in California. I don't think they're enforceable at all. If they are, they're very limited enforcement. Okay. What is the projected availability of funds at NIL? I'd love to know the answer to that, but I will say, based upon what I'm seeing with these numbers, and based upon if we're actually getting Rice, and based upon who we're talking about bringing in, I'm guessing that SC has at least $12 million available between rev share and NIL, and it might be more than that. It might be up to 14. That's a wild guess. I was trying to put this together last night, thinking about it. I was like, okay, if you assume for a second that Rice is going to cost $3 million or something, you know, around that, Kofi's going to cost around $3 million. If you look at the market, what his value is, if you were to enter the portal, I think we're making offers around that amount for him, is my guess. What it costs to get Christian Collins and the Ratliff twins, I'd say together that was probably $3 million in total to get all three of them. Maybe it's a little lower, but it was probably right in that ballpark. So already you're talking about $9 million, and you really haven't added anybody from the portal yet, but yet we're making offers into the portal. So my guess is we're in the realm of 12, maybe 14. That's a guess. I don't know this. I mean, I could be wrong. Nick, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's generally right. Kofi at three seems a bit high, but Chase, you could be right, just given the you know, market for bigs these days. Kind of hard to fathom, but
I'm
that
going,
could be
you know,
true.
I'm really just going by the Evans numbers. They project Kofi at, I'll give you the exact amount. Now, this is assuming what we've seen from other bigs, what we've heard other bigs are getting. They're putting Kofi at 2.3, with an
Okay.
upper bound at 2.8. So maybe you can get Kofi for 2.5. You know, you're going to have to pay more to keep your player probably at this point in time, because he's going to see bigger offers out there. He's a big guy. Now, he's not a dominant guy around the rim, but he is a elite defensive player. So that's my, you know, just trying to put these things together. Jason, any thoughts?
I love that Evan gives you the value for the guys, regardless of whether they're in or out, so that if anybody wants to just tamper and look at Evan's number and say like, "Hey, Jacob Kofi, I heard your value is about 2.5 mil. How would you like to hop in the portal and get that?" But no, I look, I think there was an article last year, Matt Norlander, that kind of talked to a bunch of coaches and tried to pin down where everybody was at with NIL. And I think USC was in a not necessarily the top five spenders, but there was an entire tier of like whatever that was, the next 10 to 15 schools, call it, that were around the $10 million mark estimated, right? So if you think that, and then you say the market's gone up, 30%, then that's, you're at 13, right? So it makes sense that, directionally, that's where they would be. I think they were right at, they were around 10. I think there was something during the Final Four, Mick Cronin was saying, how, oh, Connecticut, they're us plus another $5 million, and people were saying that UCLA was maybe 8 or 9, so Connecticut, 14, 15, somewhere in there. So yeah, directionally, I think your numbers are probably fairly good.
Has there been any chatter about with the new coach from Australia, Brad Davidson coming in? Any chatter about international players? I'll let one of you guys handle that one. I haven't heard anything.
Yeah, I haven't either. But that would be really interesting. It would be interesting to know what the backstory is, on his hiring. I know that he previously worked under Todd Lee, I want to say, at South Dakota. So it's interesting that, like, as Todd Lee's replacement, he's coming into USC, as opposed to Todd Lee pulling him into his new gig as an assistant. But probably the pay scale for assistants at USC would be better. So maybe if that was just a recommendation, versus if that was a targeted hire based on his, international recruiting chops, that would be another interesting angle, because that's one that USC certainly, kicked the tires on some guys last year, but we haven't quite seen them pull the trigger on anything international yet under Muss.
Yeah, and by the way, I know I have been told from a very reliable source that he is being brought in to target international guys, not just from Australia. We'll see. Obviously, Nick, we had a huge influx of European and international players this past year. A lot of them were performed much better than I think a lot of them what people were anticipating. Guys like Jop at Arizona State, I don't think necessarily people were expecting that kind of performance from him. So, it's an interesting situation. I don't know if we'll see that the fruits of that immediately, or if that's something that's more going to happen down the road.
Yeah, it's a great question, and the international recruiting is tricky, right? Because it's so relationship based, and a lot of schools can get burned by it. But you look at Gonzaga over the years and what Tommy's done at Arizona, and Illinois, the way they've built that, where if you know what you're doing and have the relationships, it can be a huge boon to your program. So, I do think whether you see results from that in year one or year two, it makes all the sense in the world to have a guy with international ties on your staff, just so you can at least get the ball rolling on those relationships and get your foot in the door.
Okay, I'm going to do some rapid fire here because we're quite a few more questions. So, Jason, will Muss play in his own defense?
I don't think so. I mean, that's just a philosophical thing with him. He only did it in like the most desperate of times, when they had no answers, and it was kind of the season was already teetering on the brink. I'd like to see it used situationally, just like based on the matchup, and if you think, hey, I want to force this team to shoot, but I don't think so. I think that's just Muss's philosophy.
Nick, will Muss use his timeouts?
I was gonna say, like, it's a is he more likely to play zone or use a timeout? I don't know. It's a great question. It again seems like a philosophical thing. Seeing him chew out Kofi for taking that timeout too was just hilarious.
Will Muss have a deeper rotation or play all the starters 35 plus minutes? I mean, we had a pretty deep rotation this year. I mean, I don't think, other than Chad, a couple of games. He didn't play the starter. I think ideally you just want to find like eight guys that is your like the anchor of your rotation and play those guys all the minutes. I think that's probably what they're going to aim for this year. And letting Amari and Dickerson go is maybe an indication of that they don't want to go 9, 10, 11, 12 deep. They're just like, hey, we're going to focus on our top 8 or 9 guys. That's my guess.
And it's something that we've talked about on the pod a little bit, that like, kind of consolidating your NIL dollars into a slightly smaller set of guys. I think we did the exercise, the first year with the Matt Nolings and the Clark Slackerts and the Bryce Popes, and it's like, you've got like a bunch of guys that kind of were toward the end of the bench, and like if you took two or three of them and combined them into like one more impact guy. I mean, in some ways that kept us afloat this year when the team was completely injured and just running out of bodies, that we at least had like enough credible players to run out a team. But like probably like most teams would just have put the money into one more kind of big dollar player.
Nick, this one's for you. What are your thoughts on Mike Malone being hired by North Carolina?
Yeah, super interesting. I see it as a pretty low floor hire, but the ceiling is substantial. I think Mike is a personable guy, despite what his reputation might be. I've talked with him actually one time. Super, super good dude. Hard to argue with the success in, I guess, the success in Denver he's had, and that the growth of Jokic and the school is very well funded from an NIL standpoint. They spent over $14 million on the roster this past year, which is hard to believe given their guard play. But boosters are there. He seems pretty energetic about the job, but it's, with the pro coaches coming back to college, even with the professionalization, the professional angle in college basketball now, still there's risk there. I mean, look at what happened with Belichick in year one at North Carolina. So fascinating to see them go down the pro model again. But he'll be able to raise money, I think, and gotta hire a good staff though. So high ceiling hire, maybe a lower floor than if you went with like a Scott Drew or a Mark Byington. But if Dusty didn't want it and Tommy didn't want it, I get why they did what they did.
Probably the best comparison I'm going to make on this is Kevin Young and BYU had a really great kind of first year breakout, made them, continue what Mark Pope had done, but actually in some ways made them like a little legit because they had done it with a new coach. But now, after spending a ton of money this past year, didn't really see improvements and had a really tough end to the season. So I'm not totally sure about that. Okay, so somebody asked, this is a, oh, there's a question about arenas. I think, we kind of addressed that. I don't think any of us know exactly what's going on there. Obviously, Troy Donovan said they think he's going to the portal. I've heard that we're not making him a focal point of retention, but we just don't know. We don't know. I'm not sure he knows, quite frankly. Not sure there is any way to objectively measure this, but our offense does not seem to create a lot of easy open looks and seems dependent on high degree difficult shots for a heavy portion of our points relative to our opponents. Maybe that's personnel shortcomings, or maybe that's just the offense must chooses to run depending on a lot of ISO and elite playmakers. I don't know if we run a lot of ISO. We do a lot of ball screens, but I really hope that would change with Mus versus Andy's teams, which seem to have the same problems, but so far it clearly hasn't. It just seems like several big teams, such as Iowa, Nebraska, Wisconsin, get a lot more offensively out of less talent, just my observation, and could be completely wrong. I'm not engrossed with team player metrics as others have. Look, I think where I'm at with this is this year was a particularly inefficient offense, mainly because we just lost all our shooting. We had no 3-point shooting. Our offense had been kind of geared around some of that playmaking, outside scoring, and then getting the ball to Ezra to score inside. Everyone was collapsing on Ezra because nobody can shoot it. I'm not sure that's a good barometer of the team. It's hard to say because year one it was like the players were not quite the players in place that you wanted to have in place. I don't necessarily see us running some sort of offensive sets that are like demonstrably worse than other teams. A lot of teams just run the same stuff. There's every team has their own wrinkle, but a lot of teams are running the same types of stuff. It's just we haven't executed as well when you don't have the players to hit the shots. But that's just kind of my opinion on this. Jason, do you have any take on that?
I will say, the Mus style certainly, yeah, like runs a lot of the kind of old school pro stuff, right? From when he was in the NBA, less of a 3-point emphasis. The team's assist percentage, which is I think how you would be able to tell if like they were scoring kind of in the flow and getting like good clean looks, as opposed to not like totally isolation. It's higher than you would think. They were 70th in 2025 season and 79th in the country in 2026 season in terms of percentage of baskets that come off of an assist. But yeah, no, I mean, eye test for me, like certainly it's not as fluid as some of the other teams. But again, Michigan, being the notable exception, obviously, because of how awesome it was watching them and the stuff that Dusty runs. But like, it does, like, I do think you have to be prepared to play, as I said earlier, like a more physical, ISO heavy style of basketball, like as you get deeper into the season, deeper into March. So I think you need to be able to do both. It's going to be really interesting to me to see, like, if and when, like, Josh Schertz goes somewhere bigger, like with his kind of ball movement, like all the pace and space, 3-point shooting, et cetera, like easy, get easy twos, no mid-range, all that stuff. Like that over the course of the season, like the math is gonna work out, but like how does that work in a big game against another marquee opponent that can take away what you do well? Like then what do you do when you can't run your stuff? So I think you can have a beautiful set offense, but you also have to be able to have, skill and kind of fallback plans when it other teams kind of junk it up on you.
Okay, so before we get out of here, I just have to pose this one rumor that's kind of just been making the rounds, which is that Blackwell from Wisconsin might be interested in going to UCLA. That's certainly been fed a bit here. Apparently, some Wisconsin guys were saying no. I mean, he might be interested, but we're not sure about that. A UCLA guy saying he's on campus today, even though it's a dark a dead period or a dark period or quiet period or whatever, and that being denied. But apparently Blackwell just posted from the Intuit Dome on Instagram. So make that of as of you will for whatever Blackwell might be doing. Who knows? Nick, anything before we get out of here?
Just say too, just to kind of add to what Jason was talking about with the beautiful offenses. I view it as you have a few elite coaches who can really run elite offense. And then other than that, it's more of just a personnel game, right? Like even if you look at Shire, like Shire's gotten a ton of praise for his in-game coaching. Despite the ugly exits the last 2 years. Duke's offense was kind of they kind of had two plays. It was just Cam Boozer isolation bully ball, and him use his size to either get to the line or shoot a two-footer, or is the pick and pop with Isaiah Evans, and they just ran that over and over again. And it wasn't really a team-oriented deal over there. But you do look at a few, and Josh Schertz definitely one of them at St. Louis. I would throw like UConn in there. UConn sets are ridiculously good. The looks they've gotten for Caravan and Braylon Mullins are exceptional, and that their movement and off-ball screens, it's definitely kind of a European model in a way that Hurley is really integrated, and Luke Murray and Kamani Young, their assistants, do a really good job there.
And it's
And
going
then
to
the
be
other
interesting with Luke Murray going to BC now, right? Like
Yeah.
how
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
offense
I mean, that
continues.
was a hell of a hire by BC. Kind of surprised he took that, but really interesting there. And the other one's Ben McCollum, right, at Iowa. And he was able to make the Elite Eight, and Bennett Sturts, is going to be a first round pick, but Ben just seems to do more with less. And his success at Drake and then this year at Iowa, it's hard to bet against him, and some of the stuff he ran in that Florida game was just so ridiculously good. So, it can work in the tournament. Eventually, you are going to be at enough of a talent disadvantage where it's not going to matter, and you can't out-scheme the other teams. But even Schertz, like I thought he gave Michigan a decent game, and then Michigan went on to just kicked the crap out of that Tennessee team and kind of cruised the title. So there are advantages, but I do think when you get to the elite level of basketball, it is more about roster construction and talent. As opposed, the coaching only gets you so far at the highest level.
Anything from you, Jason, before we get out of here?
No, it's gonna be interesting to see who else jumps in and kind of how this thing all comes together. In the past years that Mus has been here, so the past two off seasons, I want to say USC's biggest splash has come kind of at the end, right, guys? I think Claude kind of came later in the process, if I'm not mistaken,
He
but
very much so, very much so.
certainly, and Chad Baker-Mazzara was like right at the end, right? And that was when we'd lost the player from Cal State Northridge County
It
on the
was yeah,
scene.
it was almost the day after we lost. It was like the Claude left on the day the portal closed, and like the very next day we got Chad Baker-Mazzara.
Right. And then Keontae decommitted, and
Right.
it all happened fast. But that was toward the end of the cycle, right? The portal had already closed by the time Chad committed, and like I don't recall there being like any smoke about that happening. So be interesting to see how the team starts to come together. But just if anything is a pattern in the last 2 years, like Chase, you said, kind of strike early a la Donovan Dent, and then strike late maybe when the prices are coming back to earth a little bit. And certainly USC has done the strike late the past couple of years. So it'll be, I would say if we don't think they've spent the money yet, like they probably have something else up their sleeve. So we'll see what happens, but it'll be really interesting to see how this thing comes together.
Absolutely. I mean, we probably should do this again next week and see where everything's at. But until then, thank you, everybody, and fight on.
Right on.